Introducing Coco Gauff's signature shoe, more than just a tennis shoe. It's a fusion of 90s-inspired style and cutting-edge performance technology. With its sleek mid-cut silhouette, it's designed to enhance speed and power on the court. The multi-piece upper construction delivers high-energy return for players of all levels. Whether you're a seasoned pro or just starting out, the Coco CG1 empowers you to dominate the game. Learn more and purchase the Coco CG1 at NewBalance.com.
Welcome to the Tennis.com podcast. I'm your host, Nina Pantic. My co-host, Irina Falcone, missed this episode while competing at the Australian Open. Pretty good excuse. Our guest today is Joel Drucker. He's entering his fifth decade as a writer in the tennis industry, and he wrote the cover story for the January issue of Tennis Magazine about Roger Federer. We're talking with Joel about Roger Federer, of course, as well as a couple other big players down at the Australian Open. We talk about Joel's career and how he got into it, as well as some of his stories and methods and tidbits that we can learn from someone who's been in this sport for so long. Before we get into that, as much as this is a tennis podcast and we're previewing the Australian Open, there are far bigger issues going on down under. The bushfires have affected millions of animals and people in a country that tennis takes over for all of January and has created hazardous air quality in Melbourne as well as all around the country. It remains to be seen how the air quality is going to impact the Grand Slam once main draw gets underway, but there's been some rain, which is great news. And efforts to help raise funds have been phenomenal. The Grand Slams have jumped on board, donating $400,000. The tours and players have put in so much effort, donating money for aces and double faults and everything in between, as well as directly giving their prize money and also taking part in these exhibitions like the Rally for Relief, which took place on Wednesday. So with that being said, and our thoughts and our donations going to Australia for the bushfire relief, let's jump into our episode previewing the Australian Open with Joel Drucker. All right, Joe, welcome to the show. Thank you for joining us.
Sure. It's great to be here with you, Nina.
Super excited to have you on to talk about the 2020 Australian Open. It feels like it's really crept up on us. You're actually flying out, and we're recording this episode before the draw is out. So that's something to take note of. And we want to cover, you know, the man, Roger Federer. You did a cover story on him for Tennis Magazine, and that's kind of why we've brought you on. But also, Joel, I mean, it's great to talk with you and catch up. We've worked together. And tell us a little bit about you. You know, how did you get into tennis? You're a writer, and you've worked in the booth with Tennis Channel, and you've done a lot of tennis coverage. So tell us a little bit about you.
Well, I just got into tennis. You know, I played a lot when I was a kid. I played juniors in Southern California, and I wasn't a significantly accomplished player, but I really loved the game and watching it and thinking about it. And then just before I got out of college, well, I thought I was going to go to Washington, D.C., I had a chance to write for a local tennis magazine. It was kind of like, wow, oh my, this is what I was meant to write about. And then it took a little while to do that. I had 10 years having another job. And then by the time I was in my 30s, I started to freelance and just started to write more and more about tennis. I mean, tennis is really, it's this lens for how I see a lot of the world, whether it's is life like tennis or is tennis like life. And maybe that's you know, that's the way I kind of see a lot of things. So I just had a great many chances to write for magazines and stumble my way into TV and work a lot with Tennis Channel and the Hall of Fame and lots of places. Very, very fun.
And I want to ask you a little bit about how you pitch a story idea, because your Roger Federer piece, it's called Swiss Watch, What Will a Busy and Likely Pivotal 2020 Bring Federer? And it was a cover story for the January-February issue of Tennis Magazine. So, you know, what kind of goes into getting a cover story and putting it together?
Well, the concept in this case, I think, this is a case where the editor, you and I work with, Ed McGrogan, he wanted a story on Federer. And then, so then the question becomes, here's a guy who's been written about six ways to Sunday. I mean, you and I know, you and I, we've read our share of all sorts of Roger Federer stories, from David Foster Wallace to Associated Press to the New York Times, all these places. So for me, I try to think of what really interests me about Roger Federer. What do I find engaging and curious and distinctive about him? And in this piece, you know, we're looking at Roger at this crossroads and Roger where he's at. And I always like to kind of figure out what the real question is. You know, everyone likes to ask, can he win a slam, another slam? Always, can he win more slams? That to me is a fairly binary yes, no question, an outcome question. So I want to look at the process question. What needs to happen for him to win slams? And you keep asking yourself questions like that, then that almost creates the homework assignment of like, okay, what needs to happen? And if this needs to happen. And then I start to talk to people. And one of the more fun parts of journalism is what I call the hunting and gathering phase, where you interview people. And for this story, I interviewed a great many people, from our colleague Martina Navratilova and Paul Anacone, Jimmy Arias, and Matt Spielander. And these folks bring their own insights into Roger based on their experiences, players, their look at the game of analysts. You know, and again, everybody has studied Roger Federer so closely. I mean, he's like the Beatles of tennis. So that's part of the mix.
I mean, you mentioned the hunting and gathering. To me, as a reporter, my least favorite is having to hunt down sources. Like, I really hate kind of harassing people and asking them for their time. And the second I get to sit in a room with them or get on the phone with them, it's just like a relief. And that's like the most enjoyable part of the job, is when I'm actually doing the interviewing. For you, it sounds like you kind of enjoy all of it. I want to know how you figured out, or how you found out about the Ken Rosewall letter. So apparently at the Australian Open, Federer gets the envelope and it's a letter from the legend himself. I mean, how do you find this out, and what's the deal with that?
I do a lot of chatting with people that might not seem to have a purpose when I'm doing it. In other words, I learned that from Rosewall. I've gotten to know a great many of the Australian legends through my stories I've done and through this tennis fantasy camp I attend. And so I chatted with Rosewall about this a couple of years ago, and he told me about it. And so I just learned that from him, and I kind of keep that in my head. I think one of the key things in hunting and gathering is to do it all the time in kind of random ways, and then eventually something like that might work its way into a story. It's a little harder to always do it just for a story. You know, it's like I'm not going to – so it's good to just have, like, I have this, like, you know, cognitive database in my head of these things I've hunted and gathered over the years, of anecdotes, of stories, of vignettes. And I think I look at it as just, you know, chatting with people and gathering things. It's very random, and it's not scientific. You know, it's not like I have this file in my office that says Federer-related anecdotes. It struck me as very interesting that a longevity titan like Ken Rosewall would do this with Roger Federer. So he told it to me, and that was pretty neat. And then I had to ask him, I said, why don't you see him? Why don't you want to talk to him? And Roger Federer would gladly meet with Ken Rosewall. So I just keep my eyes on that kind of stuff.
That's actually genius. I mean, you kind of have these little things you can pull out of your hat when you need to. I mean, it makes, in my head, I'm imagining you writing all this down.
I think it's just kind of like spanning the globe and kind of my own interest in the tennis. It's like I, years ago, noticed the better Rosewall connection stylistically, how he played, because I've studied Rosewall pretty closely. And I remember seeing him play a little bit when I was growing up. And I wanted to bring that to light. I mean, we talk a lot about the Federer-Laver affinity, which is the Laver Cup and the great champions, and they've been on the podium together. But Ken Rosewall is someone who I think is a little less known than some of the other greats. And so that connection, I just found it kind of delicious, kind of fantastic. And the way, there are a lot of similarities in how they play.
It's kind of a new take, which is nice, because as you said, covering Roger Federer has been done every which way possible. So it's amazing to pull out something new. And you mentioned the word cup, and for me, that's kind of a trigger word. The ATP Cup just wrapped, and Roger Federer notably did not play. And now he's going into the Australian Open without having played a match since the ATP Finals in London, which was a loss to Stefanos Tsitsipas in the semifinals. You know, what do you think about this play? I think, in my opinion, I think for him playing the least is probably the smartest move, but what do you think?
I would agree with you, Nina. I think in a way, you know, Roger Federer, it's like a car you just kind of drive around the block on a Sunday to just keep it well-tuned. I mean, what is he not going to have his timing, his movement? I mean, obviously the thing for him is to stay fresh and match tough. I mean, I think he made a strategic decision not to play the ATP Cup and have this travel. And then also now with some of the weather in Australia, that makes it even more prudent for him not to have played and all of that. So maybe he's just, you know, he's Roger Federer. I mean, how many times has he come to tournaments and his timing is just so exquisite. He might not need that many matches. And I think that's his approach, whereas I think a player like Nadal always feels that he needs to make sure he's getting in reps and matches and practice and work to be in the thick of things. Don't you think that?
Oh, I totally agree. I mean, totally different cars that are driving here, because Rafa needs to be training and sweating and working out every single day, it feels like, and Roger is a little bit different. It's tough, though, because, I mean, it's so fun to compare the two of them. They're so different. And, you know, Rafa played the ATP Cup. And, I mean, when you look back on this tournament, this team event, it was like 10 grueling days. I mean, this was relentless. He played so many matches and he suffered so much, which he does, you know, Rafa does every time he plays. But, and then we have Novak Djokovic, who was flawless, 6-0. And then he pulls out of the next tournament because, I mean, again, 10 grueling days. You know, what do you
well,
think?
Well, we knew Novak was probably going to do that. You knew, you probably sensed Novak was going to be pragmatic, and no one is worse for the wear, and you can't fault him. I mean, he put his heart and soul into that ATP Cup and played some great tennis right to the end. He earned that win against Nadal to tie it up and send in some doubles, and now he's ready. You know, he has his pre-tournament gestalt. You know, everyone has their deal, right?
Introducing Coco Gauff's signature shoe, more than just a tennis shoe. It's a fusion of 90s-inspired style and cutting-edge performance technology with its sleek mid-cut silhouette. It's designed to enhance speed and power on the court. The multi-piece upper construction delivers high-energy return for players of all levels. Whether you're a seasoned pro or just starting out, the Coco CG1 empowers you to dominate the game. Learn more and purchase the Coco CG1 at newbalance.com.
Hi, everyone. You're listening to the Tennis.com podcast with special guest writer Joel Drucker. Joel is telling us about his experiences interviewing the likes of Roger Federer. Keep listening. With Novak's commitment to the ATP Cup, he really kind of lifted that event. But at the same time, I don't know, I'm kind of torn. I was in Doha for the ATP 250, and it was so nice to be at an event that was just a regular tournament, and players were so excited for 2020. And I had a really nice, great time covering that tournament, and just thinking about all the players that they lost, because Novak would have played Doha, but instead he's out in ATP Cup trying to promote this new event. And I don't know, I mean, you mentioned Labor Cup as well and all these team events. I think it's exciting, but also kind of chaotic. Like, I really struggled, maybe it's just me, to keep up with the ATP Cup. I don't know, did you?
I agree, absolutely, between the time zones and the cities and the early time of the year and who's what. I think I'm wondering if sometimes the tennis calendar is, we got the Grand Slam events, and that's a significant amount of the narrative, these four jumbo events that we pay attention to. And then the rest of the year are these kind of bursting sensations that capture us maybe with a great match, a moment, an emotional thing. For example, this year that'll be the Olympics in Tokyo. They'll be like, whoa, the Olympics every 4 years, boom, this is exciting. And there might be a neat match that happens in Indian Wells or something like in Beijing, when this year, what, last year Osaka played Andreescu, you know, like just these bursts, but not necessarily this whole 12-month flow of the year. You see what I mean? Like a series of fireworks.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That burst at the end. These team events, it's funny. So Federer's team wins the Labor Cup, and Federer is kind of the principal of the Labor Cup. Isn't Nadal very close to the new Davis Cup founder, that the new Davis Cup sponsor?
Yep, yep, and he won, yeah.
And they won Davis Cup. And then Novak kind of championed the ATP Cup, and his team won.
It's so fitting how it's all worked out the past few months in the team events. I mean, it's incredible, and it's interesting. But, I mean, I think it's just because I was just in Doha, but I feel this bias towards the smaller tournaments. I mean, you can find such amazing matches and stories at small events and the Grand Slams, and now the team events are, like, taking over. But, you know, it is what it is. It's a tournament every week, so that's the good news.
No, these team events, yeah, it is a little hard to keep track of them. Hard to keep track of which one is which, and then and Davis Cup is a little hard to follow too.
Oh my god, it was so hard for me as well. I don't know. I mean, I feel like maybe I'm not even that big of a traditionalist, but I was struggling with Davis Cup. I was struggling with ATP Cup. Maybe it's the time difference. Maybe it's I only care about, you know, semis and finals. I don't know, but I struggled with both.
I do too. I guess as journalists, we're gonna have to kind of, like, you know, re up our brain and game to keep up with that all.
I know, I need to adapt quickly. So I want to ask you about let's switch back to Federer. You know, I can't stop talking about Roger Federer. How many times would you say you've interviewed him, and do you ever get him one-on-one? What's your, like, kind of, I guess, working relationship with him?
I've been in dozens of press conferences with him, and I've interviewed him one-on-one like two or three times. I think he'd probably recognize me by face, but not necessarily by name. Working in television for many years in television production, other people were doing the interviews, and I was helping often prepare whoever was doing the interview to do the interview with him when we would have him on various Tennis Channel shows. So not to the extent, you know, I don't know him to the extent, like, for example, I knew Sampras and Agassi, who I interviewed many times and more and one-on-one quite a few times. But I will say this, Roger Federer, when you do an interview with him, and I don't know if you've had this experience, he's right there. And he's going to think of something interesting to say, and he's not forcing it. He's very engaged, always thoughtful, always a little more than you thought. And there's this whole interest level with him that he's really taking in the question. Fascinating.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've interviewed him twice in a one-on-one type situation. And, like, aside from the anxiety I was feeling, like, he's so calm and cool and collected, and he answers the questions genuinely and with thought, and he never really seems like irritated or rushed, at least not in my experiences, you know. So I agree. See what you're saying. Yeah. And then
I'll tell you a funny story about Federer and me doing an interview. This is a funny story. I was supposed to do a 20-30 minute one-on-one with him at Indian Wells 1 year.
Wow.
And I think it was like a Wednesday after a match he played, and the ATP said to me, it said, well, Roger wants to do the interview with after his match tomorrow. And I was I thought, okay, it's Roger Federer, but what if he loses? And sometimes when players lose, this has happened with other players, they lose and they go, and there goes the interview.
They're long gone. Absolutely. They have no interest.
So it's Wednesday afternoon, and I've agreed that I'm going to do this after Thursday's match. So Wednesday afternoon, Federer walks into his press conference, and he's just before he's about to sit down and do the press conference. And you know, Nina, you've been in these press conferences. There's always a little moment or two of non-chat before the press conference starts.
Right.
So I look right at Federer and I go, so tomorrow we're going to talk win or lose, right? And he looks at me back and he goes, yes, win or lose. So he knew he was committing to it. And of course, fortunately, he won.
Wow. I mean, that's so ballsy
that
of
was
you.
Kind of fun. Well, that's a little bit the price of experience in saying, look, I've been around this block. I don't want to be, I had one happen with a pro once. I'd spent weeks at like three tournaments hunting it down, and number three was supposed to be the charm, and then he lost, and then he blew out of town. Like, wow, what do I got to do here? And finally, I got the guy on the phone a month later, but geez Louise, you know?
It can be so tough, especially because it seems so easy. You're at a tournament, you put in a request, it's assumed that they're probably going to say yes. Worst case scenario, it'll be a press conference, but things happen, and the loss is definitely, once they lose, it feels like any one-on-ones are just shot. There's no chance. But I mean, I love that story. That's nice.
Yeah.
So you're packing for the Australian Open. This is, you said it was your 12th time?
This will be my 12th time to Australia.
Wow, that's really some excited. Air miles. Are you? I mean, surely you're business class by now. That's air miles.
No, I'm economy plus.
Oh my god. Okay, well, at least it's plus. So, what are you most looking forward to? I'm looking ahead now. I mean, you're a few days from being down there. Obviously, the biggest news has been the bushfires and the weather and the air quality.
You know, what's really exciting to me is seeing a lot of these women play. I think there are a lot of interesting storylines. A little bad luck that Andreescu pulled out of the tournament, but Ash Barty and Serena and Madison Keys. And I think there are a lot of different playing styles going on with the woman. I mean, we saw a bunch starting to surface at the U.S. Open, and that really interests me. I like seeing these different playing styles, these different ways, different tactics going on. I think that interests me. I mean, the big three are at the men's side are unbelievable, and let's see if someone else can really get in the mix, like whether it's Tsitsipas or Medvedev or someone like that. But I'm excited to see a lot of these women play.
I'm digging my bias into this again. I think you should watch out for Andrei Rublev. He had an amazing week at the Qatar Open, and he was just so flawless, I think.
He could be the next David Ferrer, don't you think? He could be the next David Ferrer.
He's got these slap shots. You know, he can really hit it. So and then he has a bit more height than David. So that's going to help him a bit. But the mentality, he's working on being more mentally tough, which I thought was adorable. And, you know, if he gets his act together, I think he'll be right up there. But, you know, that was one.
How about Rublev playing Alex de Minaur in a match somewhere? How would you
like
to see that one?
I mean, that would be. But it feels like de Minaur is going to be a bit more, under a lot more pressure. You know, the Australians playing in Australia, it's just going to be so tough for them. I mean, Ash Barty, we mentioned, she started up her 2020 losing to Jennifer Brady in Brisbane. She's playing in that tournament this week. So, you know, she's going to get a rhythm. But, you know, I think that's going to be interesting for her. World number one in Australia. I mean,
well, Jennifer Brady, you know, those Bruins are always testing, as you know, as one yourself.
Oh, yeah.
Jennifer Brady had a nice little round of 16 run there a few years ago. And some of those players, you know, Jennifer Brady, Danielle Collins, you know, they can hit the ball pretty well and have their moments. But, yeah, I think you're right. I think Ash Barty will be more under that spotlight even than de Minaur, don't you think? She's number one and all that stuff.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, honestly, like, I think she's such a genuine person as well. She's someone that I've met a few times and someone who you want to see succeed. You know, you want it for them so badly. So the fact that she won the French Open is kind of like, okay, you know what? She's proven herself. She's made it number one. It's great. But she's so young. So you kind of expect so much more from her moving forward versus maybe like a Halep who won a little bit later in life. And I mean, she just won two slams. She's doing fine. But the expectations feel different with Ash Barty.
Yeah, Halep, it's become, they happen so late after so much frustration, kind of the Sisyphus journey of Halep, that now it's like it's gravy time and this is all nice and good. Whereas Barty is kind of at the beginning of it all, and now she's got one where, well, could she win three or five or seven? And what's quite going to happen with her? So it's intriguing, but what a playing style. I mean, again, you get back to, I'm talking Federer, we're talking Ken Rosal, we're talking about volleys and, you know, one-handed and two-handed backhands. And it's very pleasing to watch Ash Barty play.
Oh, it is. It's different. And you mentioned Bianca Andreescu, she's not playing, but that's another person that's so unique. But we also have Naomi Osaka, defending champion. I mean, I think what I've noticed with her the past few months, she had that 14-match win streak. Lost to Karolina Pliskova in the semifinals of Brisbane, had a match point, ran out of gas a little bit, no big deal. But with her, I think her mentality and her attitude has really changed. You know, she's kind of enjoying herself. She seems happy. And, you know, even on court, you can kind of see it a little bit more. I don't know what your take is of her chance.
I would agree. I think so. You're right. I think she kind of went through that kind of whole, wow, life at the top. And Wimbledon was tough for her. And the U.S. Open, and not quite, you know, maybe a little better, but just maybe by the fall, she started to feel she could relax, or maybe she had some talk with herself and her family and just kind of like, okay, let's enjoy this. And I think she's going to be quite a force. I mean, she's such a good player. Played so well there last year.
Hey, everyone. You're listening to the Tennis.com podcast with special guest Joel Drucker. He's previewing the 2020 Australian Open. Keep listening. As someone that's behind the scenes and at these tournaments so much, watching these players day in and day out, and you see them go through a funk and get frustrated like she did mid last year, are you thinking in your head, like, come on, like, relax, dude, you've been number one, you've won a Grand Slam, your life is great, you're a pro, rich tennis player, you know, what are you thinking when you see these dips?
You know, I do think that sometimes, but then I realize, and this helps, look, I wasn't a vastly accomplished player, but I played a lot of tennis, I played a lot of tennis matches and tournaments, and you go, well, yeah, but you know, it's a hard game. You don't have teammates. So you're going to go through these ebbs and flows where it's going to feel hard to compete and hard to win. I mean, it's a really relentlessly demanding sport. You know, Nina, you play at a very high level and you know, you're going week in and week out and you're having the life of the travel, the life of the travel and the hotels and the food and the sleeping. And then you got to compete and you got someone else across the net. They're all really good. You know, there aren't many freebies in these early rounds, so you gotta bring it, and you don't have teammates, so I kind of can get that, but at the same time, there's part of it's like, hey, what a great life, enjoy it, but it's hard. It's hard. Winning tennis matches, you know, competing is easy. That's why I would tell Nick Kyrgios, competing is easy, but winning is hard. Winning is hard.
Oh, I'm so glad you mentioned Nick. I mean, well, on your thoughts there, when I think to myself, you're living the dream, you're a pro tennis player, like, I don't know why you're upset about anything. You remember that when they get on court, it really is all about being alone and playing this game that you've been working so hard at. And then when things don't go your way, you're by yourself and you're upset and you're frustrated. And it's still the same as if you're like 12 years old and trying to win a junior tournament. It kind of always goes back to those basic core feelings. And those feelings are sometimes so miserable and terrible. And you feel like it's the end of the world, even if you're a multimillionaire or even Roger, who's going to be a billionaire soon. You know, it's all about perspective. But Nick Kyrgios, we have to talk about him. Australian Open, HP Cup. I mean, this guy was killing it. And I think it's because he's on that risk of being suspended, right? He has to behave himself. He has no choice right. but to behave himself. But at the same time, he loves team events. So it's kind of a perfect storm. But now, Australian Open, I mean, I just want him to do well because it's just another person that's so fun to watch. But you just never know.
He is must watch. He is much watch tennis. I mean, he's one of those players, you know, these ones come along. I mean, Marat Safin had that Ilie Anastasi. You watch this guy do things with the ball. You think, wow, that is just amazing. And then you see other things like, what are you doing? Why are you doing this? What's going on with this? You're hitting in between your legs in the middle of a rally for no reason. Why are you, quit trying to be cool. Just play tennis. But he's definitely engaging, and I hope he's stays healthy and plays some good tennis. He's definitely fun to watch. And yeah, it's interesting how he likes the team events a little bit more, a little less pressure, a little more people looking out for him, cheering him on, all that.
I mean, him and Alex de Minaur had this bromance going, and there couldn't be, in my opinion, I mean, I don't know both of them very, very well, but they couldn't appear to be more different. I mean, de Minaur is grinding and fighting and putting in every ounce of his body into every single day, it feels like. And then Kyrgios, as you said, sometimes comes off as a little bit too cool to put in the work and to try too hard. Sometimes, you know, he'll sabotage himself. De Minaur is never going to do that. And the fact that they were bonding.
And Kyrgios knows that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they were like best friends, it looked like, and they were working together. And I'm like, this is what this team event is for. It's going to help someone like a Nick Kyrgios get his own head out of his butt.
Well, it's like the smart kid and the jock in school. You know, yeah. It's like the jock is showing up late for class, and the smart kid says, okay, come on, we're going to get through. Because De Minaur knows kind of what's good for Australia. It's like, you know, there's Australians, they never lose sight of the Davis Cup or the ATP, whatever. If it's a team event, Australians are always on board for it. So the whole concept of mateship and how you look, you know, I know these Australians way back in the day in the 60s and so when the Aussies were traveling the world. If you asked another Australian how to beat an Aussie, he wouldn't tell you.
I mean, things have changed.
Alex is looking out for Nick.
It feels like it. Yeah, but things have definitely changed. I feel like everyone's so competitive and everyone's out just for themselves these days. But, you know, and it's interesting you mentioned that because you've been in the game for so long. You've seen this change. You know, you've seen the players change. You've seen the people at the top change. You've seen the way journalism has changed, you know. And, like, are you still excited day in and day out to be covering the sport so intensely?
Absolutely. I love it. I still keep all my credentials and I get excited when I get my credential and think, wow, they're paying me this time. And I really love being around the game because the game, it's funny. I went through a period and I wrote a book about Jimmy Connors. I spent 20 years. He was like my guy and I was elementally connected to what he meant to me in the game. And now in the last 15 years or so, it's more about the game overall. So all the players, I don't have a player who I live and die with like some fans do. And I think that's great that they do. I just think the game itself and the ribbons and the texture and the mosaic of all these great players, you know, the connection to Federer, to Rosal, to a guy like Alex, to Hewitt or Kyrgios, to Anastasi. I think that's what I'm able to see when I'm taking in the game while we're watching these matches. Because, you know, and you know, you've done this too, and you spend hours and hours watching tennis matches and bringing interest and insight into them, not just what happens during the match, but what it means overall. So I think it's great. And the game, it mentions how it changes, but I'll tell you another funny thing. I spoke to people as far back as Fred Perry from the 1930s, and every generation of players has always told me, well, we played before it became about money. We were friends with each other. We used strategy. You know, for us, we played for the right reasons. Every generation thinks that they're like the tennis greatest generation. That's funny.
I love that, though. I mean, you do feel nostalgic for different eras and different decades. You know, you mentioned Pete Sampras and Andre Agassi and, of course, players before them. But I don't know. I kind of feel like it's better to think that your era and your decade is the best And, you know, the fact that the game has changed and money, I mean, money is insane now. Of course, players in the past might be a little bit envious of the cash flow we have coming in for Roger and Novak, but I don't know. I mean, I kind of like the mix there. And the fact that you're connecting the old and the new is interesting. And hence why you...
Well, to me, it's all a circle.
Oh, yeah.
To me, it's all a circle of time. It's not a line of time. It's a circle of time. And it's kind of like it's the connection of all of it. And I think the other sports romance themselves in a way that does that a lot, too. I mean, you got Jerry West as the NBA logo and all that connection to it all. And that's what makes people enjoy and relish a lot of their sports. And tennis... Yeah, tennis, the chains keep moving down the field and the players are great and the money keeps growing and they're really good. I mean, the skills of these guys, I mean, these big three, we're going to be spending a lot of time thinking about what is it that's made these guys play so well for so long. It's just incredible.
It is. It's kind of an honor to be part of this era. But, you know, you mentioned that you had a connection to Jimmy Connors and that's who you were kind of following and enraptured by, but like I don't have that kind of feeling. I haven't had that feeling at all in tennis. There's no favorite player for me. I don't. When people ask, "Oh, who's your favorite?" I literally can't even think.
Was there ever?
I think when I was younger, I was obsessed with Monica Seles because she was from Yugoslavia, and then she had the two-handed forehand, which I actually had till I was about 15. So I had that interest, but I didn't get into tennis because of a certain player. And then when I started writing about it, I wasn't like, oh, you know what, this player makes so much sense to me. And when I cover matches, of course, I have my favorites because of how they play and knowing that it's not going to be boring and it's important always. But, you know, I think it's a little different.
Well, everybody has their way of how they connect and click into the game. And look, and you also play the other. It's funny, Monica Seles, speaking of Jimmy Connors, I think they're very similar. I mean, Monica Seles is that's one of those players you'd have play for the fate of the planet. I mean, she's fantastic.
Oh, yeah.
Player.
I mean, yeah, that's one of my dream podcast guests. No offense to you, Joel.
I'm not offended. I would definitely, if she showed up right now, I'd walk off. I'd walk right off. You could have her. Fantastic. And, yeah, she's just great. But, look, everybody engages with the game in different ways. You know, the game, the styles, the personalities, lots of, and it changes. It changes. Great.
On our ending note, let me ask you, how far do you think Roger's going to go?
As far as he's meant to go. Okay. I mean, if you read my stuff.
Okay, that's safe. That's safe. I just wanted to make sure, you know, in case anyone's wondering what your take is. Like, you know, we're going to keep it safe. All right.
Cool. My take is about the process. I'm not going to let someone go to Las Vegas and do that one.
You're right. You know what? I know you're not a betting man. Okay, cool. Well, thank you, Joel. And this has been the Tennis.com podcast with Joel Drucker.
That was fun.
From the Tennis Channel Podcast Network, this has been the Tennis.com podcast. Be sure to subscribe to stay caught up. We're available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and every major listening app, as well as tennis.com/podcast. You can also see the videos of our episodes on Tennis Channel's YouTube page and tennis.com's Facebook page. We're your hosts, Nina Pantic and Irina Falcone. We'd like to thank our team, editor and audio designer and video editor, Christina Koseva, producers, Alexa March and Sean O'Malley, and executive producers, Shelby Coleman, Kyle Einhorn, and Andy Chu.